Gary U.S. Bonds. And don't forget my new book, Buy U.S. Bonds. I'm also singer of Quarter to Three, New Orleans, This Little Girl, oh, you know the rest. And you're listening to my main man, Rabbi Saul Solomon, right here on Dave's Gone By on UNC.
Well, it's a quarter to three. No, it isn't really. It's only in the morning here at the University of Northern Colorado, and I'm here with you. Shalom. I'm Rabbi Saul Solomon, the founder and spiritual leader of Temple Sons of Bitches in Great Neck, New York. But it's a quarter to three somewhere in the world because they're playing that song by the veteran singer, songwriter, musician Gary U.S. Bonds. He's had tons of hits over the years. He's had his ups, he's had his downs, he's had his avenues, and he's had his E streets. Hint, hint. We will talk right now by telephone to the wonderful Gary United States Bonds. Shalom, Gary. How are you?
Hello, Rabbi Saul. How you doing, buddy?
Apart from my prostate, which is always problematic, I'm fine. How are you? How is your health?
I'm doing okay, very well. I was out last night with little Steven and Bruce and all the boys with the Rascals, and we had a little party, so I'm not doing that well today.
So you're still partying like it's 1959, I can see that.
No, but I can tell you that's a hard time now, I tell you.
Now, it's very busy on Broadway right now, so you just went to see the Rascals show? How was it?
Once Upon a Dream, a very, very excellent show that Steve Van Zandt has produced and directed, him and his wife Maureen. It's a great show.
Oh, good. And you and the gang, as it were, little Stevie and a fellow named Bruce went?
Yeah, Bruce was there. I even saw Tommy James was there. And, oh, my God, everybody was there. It was an opening night for that, you know. And it was a great opening night. Cousin Brucey was there.
Oh, how's he doing? He's getting older, but is he in good shape?
He's in great shape. Him and I hung out for about an hour last night. So, yeah, he's in good shape because he can talk you to death if need be.
Well, so can I on a given day. Do you remember the very first time you met some of the great radio DJs like Cousin Brucey, and you probably met Wolfman Jack and folks of that era? Alan Freed,
yeah,
even.
Wolfman Jack, of course, Dick Clark, and then there was Jocko Henderson.
Jocko, right. Oh.
There was Papa Hot Rod, and my old friend down in Norfolk, Virginia was Jack Big Daddy Holmes. I know all of them. Jerry Blavitt, I still talk to about once a month.
Jerry Blavitt, yes, that is another name from the a blast from the past, as it were, or a blast from the past.
Yes.
So, can you remember though the very first time you both heard your song on the radio, and the first time you ever went to a radio station to be like interviewed or to push a record?
I was sitting on my front porch with me and a couple of my friends and my mom and my grandma. This was in Norfolk, Virginia.
Okay.
And you know, down south, you always, you know, you kind of sit out on the front porch and everybody comes by, you wave and toot your horn, you know. And we were there, they had the radio on out there. And all of a sudden, this song comes on, New Orleans. And Jack Holmes, Daddy Holmes, said, and that's a new record by, meanwhile, we were ecstatic on the porch, my whole family and I. And that was a new record by one of Norfolk's own, Gary U.S. Bond.
Wow.
And I went, Gary, who the hell is Gary U.S. Bond? I only been in show business 2 minutes, and somebody's already stolen my record. So I didn't know they had changed my name from Gary Anderson to U.S. Bond by then.
How can they, your manager, there's a story about that on Wiki, but tell us, your manager just felt that it was a better name somehow, or your old name conflicted with something? What was the story?
No, he wanted to use Gary U.S. Bonds. The whole story is there was a guy next door had a delicatessen called Mr. Cod, next door to the studio.
Yeah.
Mr. Cod was a big fan.
Oh, okay,
Of U.S. Bond. He had the big statue of Uncle Sam, and he had this huge flag and also a huge, huge banner in his store of a United States savings bond. And during that era, that was the time that they were trying to sell him, and he was one of the big guys trying to sell it out there. So Frank thought that was a great idea. He put that on the label on the sleeve of the 45 and sent it to the DJs, and it was titled "By U.S. Bond," but B-Y, not B-U-I.
Right, right, right.
The DJs thought it was a promotion for United States savings bonds.
Oh, that's marvelous. So they were compelled, perhaps, to play it even more than they would have just a new single. They thought, oh, well, I should play this from the government.
They were going to promote U.S. bonds, and some of them, they'd already did the intro to U.S. bonds, and then they put on this record, and all of a sudden this music comes out, and they went, well, what happened here?
So this was, New Orleans was your first hit.
That was the first one, yes.
Quarter to Three came later, was right?
Yeah, it was New Orleans first, and then Not Me was the second record that the Orleans did about 3 years later. But Not Me was the second one, and that was banned on the radio because they said it had dirty language in it.
Now, wait a minute. What is dirty about Not Me?
Come on over, baby. Let's have some fun.
Yeah.
And I'll punch you in your face.
Oh, well, that's pretty, it's not dirty.
I was a bad guy. I was a red fox of the 60s.
Well, do you remember writing, did you write the lyrics to the song, or were you just singing that one?
That was Joe Royster actually wrote that. He was laughingly referred to as the studio engineer.
So
he had written that. It was a country song, and I changed it around.
But the lyrics were his, including the so-called naughty-ish lyrics.
I'm sorry, but yeah, oh, Not Me. Yeah, I wrote that.
Oh, you did write that one. Okay, got it.
Well, I did write. New Orleans was Joe Royster.
I'm sorry. Okay, good. So you are the naughty boy. You are the bad person talking about punching people and come down to my place. We'll have some fun.
Ooh, I know, ooh. But if those guys are still living, I bet you they're having heart attacks right now.
Oh, I've said much worse.
This day and age, you can say anything. Hi, this is Gary U.S. Bonds. And don't forget my new book, Buy U.S. Bonds. I'm also singer of Quarter to Three, New Orleans, This Little Girl, you know the rest. And you're listening to my main man, Rabbi Saul Solomon, right here on Dave's Gone By on UNC.
But let me ask, you started singing in church, and then you flipped to sort of the blues and the rock and roll. But you said your family was ecstatic hearing your music on the radio, so there was no problem in the fact that you were moving from church music to secular music?
And basically only at one church because the reverend there used to love to hear me sing, and I would go by his church every Sunday, and he would tell the people in there that Gary's going to come in and sing, and he'd give me $5.
Ooh, wow.
And I'd come in, I'd sing my little song, and then I'd leave out, and me and the boys would run down the street and buy a bottle of orange vodka.
Oh, come on. How old were you?
At the time, I was like 17, but you could always get somebody to go in and get it for you.
Wait, but did you say 17 or 7?
16 or 17 years old at the time when that happened.
Yeah, oh, my. Did the priest have any idea where his money was going, where the collection...
Of course I wouldn't tell him that. I told him I was going to give it to my mother.
Oh, well. You were a bad boy. Like, were you a juvenile delinquent of some sort?
I was probably a big liar then, and I talked dirty, right?
Well, we know how dirty you're talking. I mean, it's not so bad, but I'm just wondering if you did anything else even worse than buying underage vodka, with the money from a priest, for God's sakes.
No, I mean, that was about as hard as I got back then.
I mean, I would take, the rabbi would give me money, but I would just go buy, bakery goods.
Yeah, right.
That wasn't that bad. Now, you made a joke early, I think off the air, to either me or Dave, who is the host of this radio program, about, boy, you wish you knew how to get rich quick or make a lot of money in a day, that sort of thing.
But oh, yeah.
What I'm wondering is, you had a gold record in 1961 with A Quarter to Three.
Yeah.
Didn't that generate money, or were those the days when the artist got next to nothing? I mean, it should have made a huge difference in your lifestyle, at least at the time.
Yeah, we did, but, you know, unfortunately during those days, you didn't get everything that was supposed to come to you. There were a lot of hands in the pot. So by the time you got down to your portion, you know, the food was already consumed.
Good Lord. But let me ask, though. I mean, you hear all these stories all the time about there's all this money being made, and it just trickles to the artist. But at the same time, for a little period of time, the artist has a nice car, they get a lot of free nice food, they get hookers, whatever it is. Did you at least enjoy the spoils for a bit?
Wait a minute.
What?
Get hookers?
Well,
see, I told you you'd get robbed back in those days.
Well...
No, it, you know, even like with some of the records I got, you know, like I wrote Quarter to Three, me and Daddy G.
Uh-huh.
But when you look on the record when it comes out, there's always somebody else involved, not me. I wrote that alone. School is out, me and Daddy G. But like I say, there's too many hands in the pot.
So
you don't know.
Well, later on, by like 20 years later, let's say, by the 1980s, when you're still making records, do you have at least a bit more control so that what you were releasing may not have sold a million copies anymore, but at least at that point...
No, I had to, after I realized what was going on, that was only about 3 years. 3 years later, I changed that whole act around.
Oh, very nice. Good.
No, I changed that around. But I'd already, you know, Quarter to Three was a big, 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 big hit for me. So I kind of lost out on that, and not me, and school is out. But the rest of it I did pretty good with, you know?
So have you been able to live comfortably as a musician from the very beginning, from like the 1950s all the way through now?
Well, that's all I've ever done. I mean, that's my only job has been that since I was a teenager. That's all I've done was sing. I've never had another job. Well, that's a lie. I had two other jobs. One, my father-in-law hired me to work with him. He was a chef.
Ooh.
He hired me to work with him in the restaurant, you know, and that lasted a week.
Oh.
So he fired me.
Why did he fire you? Were you burning things? Were you...
No, well, actually what happened was one day, about the second day that I was there, because I had to be in there at 9 o'clock, which meant I had to get up at, you know, 7:30 to start heading out at 8 to be there at 9.
Right.
And I had a bright idea, and I says, hey, look, Pop, I don't understand why I got to be at the restaurant at 9 o'clock, because there's nobody in the restaurant. I'm just washing dishes, you know, cleaning pots and pans. And there's no dirty pots and pans and dishes at 9 o'clock. They don't get dirty until around 11:30. So I'll just come in then.
Well.
And he fired me.
Oh.
It made perfect sense to me.
It does make sense. I mean, why didn't he just explain to you why you had to come in earlier for various reasons instead of just firing you on the door? Did he try to explain his motives?
Yeah, he did, but Mom wouldn't let him get too far.
Oh. Oh, well. Oh, I thought it was going to be a story where you were pouring orange vodka on people's French toast.
Yeah, exactly.
A whole diner full of alcoholics, I guess. But so what was the other? You mentioned there were two other jobs.
Yeah, then my buddy got me a job at Atlanta Shop, a woman's dress shop. And
well, that must have been fun.
I did. Well, I got fired from that because, you know, the big long dress boxes that come in.
Yeah.
And so I was upstairs and I was supposed to be sorting out the boxes. And the owner came up and caught me sleeping in one of the dress boxes on top of the dresses.
Naughty, naughty, naughty. But then again, was this before you were doing your music, or was it at the point when all night long you'd be playing with bands and doing clubs and stuff like that?
Oh, it was during that time, too, you know, because I was right there in town.
Oh, my gosh. Well, by the way, we are talking with Gary U.S. Bonds, who has been a restaurant worker for a week and a dress shop worker for another week and a musician for, my gosh, what would it be now? We'd be talking about 58 years, roughly. I can't do math.
1959, I started professionally.
My goodness. So what was, it's an impossible question, but what would you say is the most exciting, top, funnest, greatest moment of your professional life?
I guess probably meeting Elvis in Vegas years and years ago.
Wow. Now, was this big fat on the toilet peeing up on a sandwich, Elvis?
No. This is a slim, good-looking guy that had the world by its tail.
What? So you met him? I'll bet he was really courteous and polite. Is that true?
One of the sweetest people I've met ever. And he invited me. He sent a card out for me to fling. I was there with the Dick Clark Caravan of Stars.
Oh, my.
And up in my room, and then this guy came, the chauffeur came and said, "Mr. President would like you to like for you to come down to the hotel and spend some time with him." So there's another long story to that, but anyway, I got it.
Well, then you can tell the story. That's what we're here for. Is it an interesting story?
Well, I just gotten into the hotel. We had been flying, you know, back in those days, they didn't have the quick flights to Vegas. You took the prop and it took you a long time to get there.
Okay.
And so we were pretty tired when we got there. It was like me and the Shirelles and the Coasters, the Drifters, a bunch of us. And I got into the bed, and I was laying there, and then the phone rings, and this guy says, "Hi, this is so-and-so-and-so. I'm the chauffeur for Elvis Presley, and Mr. Presley would like to see you down at the hotel. Could you come down?" And I thought it was one of the guys joking.
Well, okay.
So I says, "Hey, look, I don't know who this is, but don't do this. Let me get some sleep. You know, I got a show to do later on." And I slammed the phone down.
Oh.
A couple of seconds later, the guy calls back. Anyway, he did this for like three times. Till finally, he said, "Look, you got to do me a favor. Trust me, I'm not kidding around here. Just come downstairs for a second. You'll see me. You know who I am. I got on the chauffeur's jacket, the chauffeur's cap, and the car is parked right out front." Sure enough, I went down, and there it was. It was the guy there, and it was the big, long, stretch white limousine with Elvis tags on the back. And that was it. I finally got a chance to go, but that took about an hour for him to get me to come downstairs to do that. And then I went down there and waited around about, 40, 45 minutes in this big, empty room with two chairs. That was it. Just a big ballroom with two chairs in it. And eventually Elvis came in and and we just sat down and we talked man stuff and
what do you remember about your conversation?
Well, we just talk about who looked good out on the road, talking about the girl singers and
yeah.
Who sang what, and then he talked about music styles and how the Coasters were so much fun with their records, and he wanted to know how I made mine. We did about 2 hours of just silly stuff.
Now, you didn't have guitars or there were no instruments. You didn't jam or anything. You were just talking, sitting in chairs talking.
Yep, just him and I sitting down having a conversation,
Now, did you ever run into him again or have any other meetings with him?
Well, he invited me down that night because our show was early. He said, "So come down to my late show and I want you to be my guest of honor." And I went down there and he sat me right in the front in the middle booth. In Vegas, they got those big booths up there that sit there with the cushions all on them and set up the bottle of champagne and some hors d'oeuvres and flowers and all, and it's only me. And so I felt so uncomfortable just sitting there by myself and all these hundreds and hundreds of people around me looking at me like I'm the king of Farouk or something.
Yeah, until finally.
And he introduced me and from stage and just made a big deal out of it. That was really thrilling to me.
That is very, very, very nice. But after that night and that day, no contact, no other...
Never got to see him again.
That's but you know what? You have a wonderful memory of seeing him in the prime. That's pretty neat.
I had to settle for Wayne Newton.
What do you mean settle for Wayne? There's nothing wrong with Wayne Newton.
Not at all. He's one of my next greatest entertainer I've ever seen.
Now, is it true that he's currently broke? Is that the deal? Or he's having all sorts of financial trouble? Which astonishes me, since he's got this sweet gig in Vegas.
Whenever I hear about those guys being broke, and I'm thinking, I should get to that level of broke. $10 million left.
Oh, isn't that awful?
Yeah.
Isn't that terrible?
I don't know how I'm going to buy my next island.
Now, another person that you are, were friends with, and apparently close friends, was the late Otis Redding.
Otis was a very good friend of mine. He was a sweetheart. He was a friend, as well as a bunch of other guys that I know, you know. But Otis was one of the, he was just a big baby.
What do you mean?
Well, you know, just a big guy. You would think he was so intimidating, you know, and you sit down with him, he was just like, he was a teddy bear.
That's
a real big teddy bear. He was a sweetheart.
Did you, in your knowing him, did you get any clues to what made him tick musically? How he had as much soul as anybody who ever sang in that form?
Oh, yeah. Well, when I first saw him, my stepfather was from Macon, Georgia. So he used to take me down to Macon, Georgia, and I'd go out to the little clubs, because they had what they called the chitling clubs back down there.
Right.
And so I'd go in there and watch him. And at that time that I was seeing him, he was imitating a lot of people, mostly Little Richard. And he had a big 8-10-piece band, I think it was. I know it was a large band. And he was doing, you know, bop bop a loo bop bop bam. I mean, just like Little Richard. And all those guys he was imitating. He was great doing that. When he got to Otis Redding, to his style, that came from when he got in the studio and just kind of fiddling around. He wanted to do, I think what happened was somebody, the producer, fired at the studio that day. And Otis said, well, I got a song, and I think he did These Arms of Mine or something. He'd written.
Oh, wow, yeah.
And the guy let him go ahead and record that. And that became a big R&B hit for him.
Well, it was great, yes.
And he created that style of singing from right then at that point.
Well, did you yourself imitate people before you found your own particular style, or was it just a natural? You were always Gary Bonds, Gary U.S. Bonds, doing it your way.
Oh, I used to love. My greatest guy that I wanted to be was Clyde McFadden.
He was from not the Platters. What was
he was from the Drifters.
Drifters. Thank you. Yes.
He was with the Drifters, the early Drifters. And I used to. What did he have on before? There was it Lovey Dovey and you know the landlord ring my front doorbell. One of those. I forgot the name of it. But that was one of his first songs, and I used to try to imitate him or emulate him. And I couldn't get my underwear tight enough to get those high notes like he did. So I just kind of gave up on him. Then
oh,
I started trying to do Sam Cooke.
Oh,
and I couldn't sing that doggone good. So I said, well, you know, maybe I better find my own style, because doing these other people ain't working out too good for me.
Well, the reason I talk the way I do is I wear a hernia truss. See, I've got a beautiful Pavarotti-like voice, but I have to wear this very tight hernia truss, and it makes me sound like this. So it's very sad, actually. What can I tell you?
I don't think they were out when I was there.
That could be. We're talking with the delightful Gary U.S. Bonds. We want to remind everybody, we haven't even mentioned this, but he has a book and a CD out together, that you get the CD with the book. It's all this combined thing. It's called That's My Story, and I'm Sticking to It. It's co-written with Stephen Cooper, and it has a foreword by Little Stevie, Stephen Van Zandt. And by the way, just to add on to this for the big celebration of the book and the CD, the 74th birthday, happy birthday to you, just about, by the way.
Thank you, yes.
74th birthday celebration will be at B.B. King's Blues Club, with appearances by Ben E. King, Darling Love, Little Stevie, of course, and someone you've known for a very, very long time. Why don't you tell us about this?
Well, Chuck Jackson's going to be there, you know, and it looks like Bobby Rydell says he wants to show up. So that's going to be good, you know. Other than that, you know, we got some surprises.
Well, wait. But also, I'm talking the man who was on your earliest hits instrumentally.
Oh, yeah. He's going to be Daddy G.
Daddy G. Gene Daddy G. Barge, the saxophonist.
He's 86 years old. And and oh my God, he'll scare both of us because he acts like he's 26.
That's what. Well, let me ask you. You will be 74 in a couple of days.
Yeah.
How do you? Thank God, you said you were healthy. You said you're fine. Have you slowed down at all? Do you feel any different from the way you did when you were 24, 34?
Only with my back. I heard it playing golf, and it won't heal.
Playing golf.
That's the only thing. I just can't hit the ball as far as I used to. But now, I do hit it straight.
You are kind of known for playing golf. You do a lot of charity tournaments, and that's been a thing.
Yeah.
How many years have you been playing golf?
Oh, I started that when I was, I think, 13 years old.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, I found this 8-iron on the golf course down in Norfolk, and I just started swinging the club, and then finally the golf pro out there had me hustling all his clients, because I could go out there and play with all those, well, you know, the segregation back down in Norfolk at that days.
Right.
And there was this little black kid beating up on all these rich white people out there on the golf course with one club.
And this is before Tiger Woods, let me tell you. It's like it's...
And the pro there was supporting me. He would sucker them in for me.
Nice!
Of course he'd take half of the money anyway.
Well, yeah. Well, at least he didn't take 80-20, you know.
He didn't do 80-20. He took 50 of it, but he'd get them all. Oh, yeah, play the kid. He's got money, and he'd back me.
Well, no, but this also brings up, I mean, you've danced around the edges of this because you mentioned Otis Redding on the Chitlin circuit, as it were, and then now with the segregation. I mean, how much has segregation and racism in America and your being a black person, how much did that hold you back? How did that affect you in doing what you've done since the 1950s?
Well, it did set me back. It wasn't as easy, but you know, you just work twice as hard until you get to what you want. I mean, everything's possible. But during those days back then, you had to. I mean, you had places to work. There were places you couldn't go.
Right.
That were easily there for the white artists to make money with. And we had to settle for little, you know, backyard chicken joints or whatever we could to scrap out $5 or $10. But, you know, you do what you got to do to get where you got to go.
And even, like, when you hear the stories about the jazz people who were touring, and I assume this affected you and your bands in the 50s as well. Like, when you would go to play a place, you would have to stay in a hotel or a motel that was specifically for colored people as opposed to being able to... Yeah, I mean, this was all part of just... what you had to do.
I remember coming back from Suffolk, Virginia, but me and the band I was with at that night was called Sleepy King's Band. I don't know, that was what he called himself, Sleepy King. And it was Sleepy King's Band, me, and Ruth Brown. Of course, you know who Ruth
Of course,
Brown.
Yes.
And she was just singing with me during that time. And we get stopped on Route 13 coming back and by the police. And they make us take all the equipment out of the car. Because we're traveling in cars now. We didn't have buses and vans and all that stuff, you know.
Right.
And had to take it out on the highway and start playing because they wanted to hear us play. And that's what we did. This was like 2, 3 o'clock in the morning. You know? And then they go, all right, yeah, you guys are all right. Okay, y'all go ahead now. And we got to pack the stuff back up and then head on down the road.
Well, as awful as that is that at least the worst incident that you recall of coming up against, you know, point blank?
Yeah, no, we did. There was no beatings or hangings or anything, thank God, you know.
Well, yeah, thank God. I mean, back then. You know,
yeah.
Back then. So, wow. Wow. We're talking with Gary U.S. Bonds, who is going very strong at age almost 74. Can I ask, there's people on some level tend to be a little disparaging of what they call oldies acts, like when the Platters or the Drifters or whoever will get up, they'll go on cruise ships, they'll do their thing, and it's sort of looked down upon in some ways by the rock intelligentsia, by the critics or the hip people, so to speak. How do you straddle the line between doing nostalgic work, playing songs from 50 years ago, and also trying to do new stuff?
Well, that's it. I mean, I never stop trying to do new stuff. A lot of the guys just give up. and stop recording, and then you know, they get very ticked off when somebody says, well, you got to do an oldie show. Well, you haven't tried to do anything new, you know, so don't get mad at them. It's just sticking you where you are, But me, they don't know where to put me, because every few months I'm out with a new album, a new song, a new something, you know. But and then I can go back and do those oldies. I can go back and do it, but I can come back and do the newies.
I mean, yeah, the Rolling Stones are an oldies act too, but nobody seems to mind that so much, you know.
Nobody seems to mind that. The Rolling Stones, oh my God. Yeah, they are back in the day. Well, not as old as me, but they're back there.
Just getting only a few years difference, really. Just
that's
a couple.
That's right. Yeah.
Now, one person who or group.
Paul Anka. He's not. You know, they don't say anything about him being an oldie.
Who's that? Who?
Paul Anka.
Oh, well, yeah, under discussion. Come on, what was the last Paul Anka song you heard on the radio? That you're singing along
my
with?
Way, I guess it wasn't. He didn't sing it.
Right, yeah. And that's only 40 years back. Come on, Paul Anka.
I know. But yeah, that's the last one I remember.
But okay, but let's... The people who helped keep you regenerated, because, okay, you had your big hits in the early 60s, and then the British Invasion came and knocked a lot of people out of the box, and I'm sure the 70s was kind of certainly a little difficult for you.
Yeah.
In the sense of not getting the airplane, not getting the... But you still just made records and you toured. Is that how you got by?
When during the 70s, that was all disco era. I did a lot of the... what they call the Holiday Inn circuit. The hotels were doing a lot of shows there, and their little ballrooms and stuff, you know. So I did those a lot. And, you know, I actually did some malls.
Okay.
They used to have a thing where you could go to malls and play, you know. That was disgusting. But you could make a couple of shekels here and there, you know.
Yeah, and some people would discover it. I think the singer Tiffany was discovered in the Long Island Mall. Yeah,
exactly.
So, a space is a space. You put up an amplifier, a guitar, you start playing wherever the hell it is, you know. And in some ways...
You gotta go where you gotta go.
It beats a chicken shack joint, you know.
I know. No, not really, because you did get some good chicken.
That's right, all you get in the mall is KFC. You're right.
Right.
But what happened in the 1980s where you got hooked up with Little Stevie and that whole group and something exploded for you? Please tell.
Well, that was good. But Bruce came to see me at a show in Jersey. I think the club was called the Red Baron or something. It had a big stupid airplane on top of the roof. And I was in there working. I had no idea who he was. He came in and a couple of his buddies came up and said, look, a friend of mine is sitting there with us. He wants to come up and sing a couple of songs with you. I said, okay. And I was sure. They told me his name, and I went back up, and I said, well, this is going to give me a chance to go get me a beer. I said, hey, ladies and gentlemen, here's a fellow out there I want you to meet. He's a great guy, you know. Give him a nice round of applause. He'll do a good job for you. Bruce Springsteen. And the crowd went absolutely berserk.
So he was already famous very famous at this, but you had never heard of him.
I had never heard of him because I was working the Holiday Inn circuit. I wasn't listening to radio. I was trying to learn new songs, but basically in that Bruce Springsteen song.
Right. Well, yes, of course. So he gets up there, and then suddenly you realize, oh, I've been missing something here.
I know. Whoa, what happened here? Who is this?
And did you get your beer, or did you stick around to watch him sing?
I stuck around, and I never got the beer. I stuck around, and him and I, we stayed on stage for about an hour and a half just singing all kinds of songs. And the crowd was just going, wow.
I can totally imagine that. And then you became, it wasn't just one of these one-time things. You have stayed in touch. They played on your albums. He sung on your albums.
We became friends that night, and from then on, then he invited me down a couple of weeks later to work with him at the stadium, at a big Coliseum in Jersey. And I went over and did some songs with him there, and then he invited me down to the next venue he was working at, and I did some songs there, and then we just, all of a sudden, I looked 2 or 3 years later, we were in the studio together.
That's, so tell us something about either singing with Springer, working with him in a studio, making music with him, and or just hanging with him.
with Springsteen?
Yeah.
Oh, he's a cool guy. He really is a nice, just like you see him on stage, that's exactly how he is in person.
Huh.
He's the same guy. Nothing changes. Steve Van Zandt is also the same. Crazy. He's crazy.
What's a crazy thing that you saw Steven Van Zandt do?
Oh, well, first of all, the bandana.
Oh.
But no, he's just a talented guy. To sit and talk with him, he's just, he's a laugh a minute. He's always joking, and he's got something humorous to say at all times. So, you know, to have a conversation with him is like a lot of fun.
And any memories of the big man, Clarence Clemons?
Yeah, well, Clarence and I, we kind of grew up together now. He's from Norfolk.
Oh, okay.
Where I'm from. But actually, he was in Chesapeake. I was in Norfolk, which is like, it was a long distance away, about 3 miles. So I kind of knew him from down there. We didn't hang out because he was in another area. He played in different areas, you know, than I did. But we knew of each other.
Okay.
And that was it. We didn't play any ball or anything together, but we knew each other.
Okay. And then, but at the point when you were starting to be friends with Bruce and the E Street Band, did you then get close, or were you closer?
Well, yeah, once, you know, once we saw each other again, because after that, I knew he was with Bruce, you know, and then he knew that me and Bruce were hanging out. And then when we get together, we basically talk about Norfolk.
Nice.
You know, and all the things we had missed down there, and what was gone, and what they tore down, and where we used to go to eat, and you remember this girl, you know, the routine.
It always comes down to girls, doesn't it?
I don't know why.
Oh, well, look between your legs, you'll know why, of course.
Well, I haven't seen a girl in over 50, you know, I've been married now 50 years this March.
Mazel tov, a 50th anniversary, congratulations.
Indeedy, we did it to the same girl.
Oh, well, maybe not congratulations, I don't know. And the interesting thing is sometimes your wife and your daughter help you make music. Is this how you enjoy keeping in the family? Do they love all being part of it?
Oh, yeah, well, they travel with me. They're my background singers on the road.
Wow. Well,
yep.
Because you are a person who has to tour to make a living and be in the studio, I mean, did you feel like on some level your daughter maybe missed out a little bit of a normal father childhood, or by taking her into the background singing and all that, you're closer than most families?
Oh, she was with me. Now, my wife was also with the Love Notes years ago. They had a couple of big hits back in there before me.
Oh.
And then she left that and hooked up with the New Century Platters, who were based out of Canada.
Okay.
And so and they toured for 10 years together. So when my daughter wasn't with me, she was with my wife on the road with her. So she's always been on. She's been on the road since she was like a teeny, teeny baby.
So she doesn't actually know anything else. She must be so used to it and love it now. And then she gets to go all over do tour internationally with the family.
Oh yeah, oh yeah, yeah. We just got back. She was with me in Europe. She's also produces with me and writes with me, and she handles the studio here with me also. So we do everything together.
That's wonderful. Now, speaking of international things, I do have to ask that one of the things on your bio and resume is the fact that you headlined the tour years ago with a couple of young British men who went on to do a couple of good things.
Yeah, you know, and the story on that, I don't know why they keep bringing it, but I haven't confirmed it, which is why we didn't put it in the book, because the only reason I said that it was the Beatles that backed me was because that's what my manager, Frank Guida, told me. I come to find out, sometimes he lies. So I really don't know until I can confirm it that they were really the Beatles that backed me.
So it could have been just a couple of other British. It could have been a Dave Clark 5, for all you knew.
It could have been a Dave Clark 5.
Because this is in 19, what? This would have been late 50s, early 60s then, before, obviously, you know, they may have been the Silver Beagles or nothing. You know, could have been Stu Sutcliffe, for all you know.
Yeah, I don't know, but let's see, it was me, Gene McDaniels was on the show, and Johnny Burnett.
Okay.
The headlining.
Don't know these people. Can I ask, is your manager, that guy, still alive, or is he gone?
No, he's gone.
Oh, so how would you find out whether or not? What would be a method to find out whether you were actually backed by, you know, John Lennon, Paul McCartney?
I'd have to go back and see if I could find who booked the show. Or maybe there's something in the papers there from, what year was that, 1962 or 63?
Well, 63, they would have known.
Or something.
Yeah, 63 already, the Beatles were so enormous, at least in England, Ben. It's unlikely that, well, who knows, maybe.
Could, I mean, let me tell you something. If I can find one of my fans over there from, unfortunately, my fan club president died.
Oy.
So I can't ask him, but if I could find somebody that was in the fan club over there, they might be able to root it out for me, you know?
What's kind of funny is my fan club president wants to die. He says, I can't believe I'm following this man. I wish someone would shoot me. It's very tragic. We're finishing up our fabulous conversation with Gary U.S. Bonds. Again, I just want to remind people that he's going to be 74 years old, with Mazel Tov, and on June 5th, is that the date, June 5th, is when you turn 74?
June 6th is the actual date. Ah. June 5th is where we go to B.B. King's.
So the night before, so you'll probably stay up and party just so you can be awake at 12:01 for your birthday.
Well, at 12 o'clock, that we'll be into the book signing, because as soon as I do my show, we're going to move from B.B. King's to the club right downstairs from it called Lucille's. And we're doing the book signing there.
Oh, I'm so glad I brought that up. So, yes, it's his new book, That's My Story, and I'm Sticking to It, which
his
was...
His book is By U.S. Bonds.
Oh, the name of the book is By U.S. Bonds.
Yeah.
And then the CD is That's My Story, and I'm Sticking to It?
Exactly.
Okay. Oh, I knew this was confusing. And you get the CD and the book together. So maybe if you mish them all together, it's like, that's my U.S. Gary story sticking to Bonds.
So yeah, by U.S. Bonds, that's my story. And the record is, that's my story, I'm sticking to it. Now, the record is just a four-minute version of what's in the book. So lyrically, it's pretty cool. You check it out, you'll see.
This CD is just it's a one-song CD, or is it an album?
One-song CD.
Oh, okay. Okay. Boy, oh boy, did I have all my facts wrong. I'm sorry. So, but you get it free with a book. And by the way, who's the publisher?
Wheatley Press.
Weekly? Spell it, please.
W-H-E-A-T-L-E-Y.
Oh, like wheat. Wheat. It's sort of, it waves at you like wheat. Wheatley Press.
Yeah, it waves. Hello.
Hello. With a foreword by Stevie Van Zandt, and also the book was co-written with Stephen Cooper, kind of an as-told-to thing, I guess. And so you can get the book, or bring it, of course, to B.B. King's Blues Club right in Manhattan on 42nd Street on June 5th, and stay there, and he'll sign it. It'll be great, and you'll see all those wonderful people. So I guess the last quickie question or two for Gary U.S. Bonds. What's on your iPod? Do you even have an iPod? And if you do, what have you been listening to?
I do have an iPod. I've been listening to a lot of. I love this little kid, Bruno Mars. I think he's great. You know?
Yeah, of course, yes.
And I still listen to some old songs. I listen to Otis Redding again, and then now I just got into this Beatles Come Together because I want to do that in my show. I love that song. It took me a long time to love that song. Now I can't get it out of my head. So yeah, I'm a little slow, I guess. I listen to a lot of Beatles.
Yes.
You know? Of course, I can't help but listen to, the King of Rock and Roll, you know, which I call Little Richard. So.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Elvis again, but Little Richard, of course, yes.
Yeah, no, but, you know, here they have the Elvis station. I guess they got it everywhere. Oh, Sirius.
Oh, they have it. I didn't realize that. I know if you were serious about that.
Yeah, they got that. They got those serious. But mostly I listen to Lil Steven's Garage radio show.
Now, can I ask last question for Gary U.S. Bonds? Do you have a favorite song of all time? Not of your own, but that someone else.
I have so many favorites.
Oh, good.
Rabbi, I love singing Spanish Harlem, Benny King's Spanish Harlem.
I think
that's such a really neat song, you know.
It's a beautiful song, absolutely.
Yeah, it's absolutely great, you know, but...
And Benny King will be at your birthday party, which is also kind of wonderful. And do you have...
He's my main buddy. We talk all the time.
And in all your discography over the years, in the last, 50-something years, is there a song... I might not be able to find it or play it, but is there a song that you love that maybe people don't know about, that wasn't a hit single, that's buried on an album track, but a song that you kind of wish millions of people knew that you did?
Well, there's a song Lil Steven did called Daddy's Come Home on the Dedication album, which is my greatest song of all times, you know. I love that song. And then there's a song that my daughter wrote called Just Like a Child, which is a beautiful song, and that's on the American Men's album, you know.
Okay, we're going to have to look for those. Look for the discography of Gary U.S. Bonds, 74 almost years old, and going super strong, and being a super delightful guest in the neighborhood. I can only wish you much, much more health, many more birthdays, and much more music. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Rabbi Saul.